Hi, I'm Paul Fotenauer, and welcome to Frontiers, where we showcase UC Davis research that helps us understand and live in a changing world. These days, it's difficult to read the sports page or watch sports news without hearing about a high-profile athlete who has tested positive for taking a performance-enhancing drug. With the lucrative rewards available in professional sports and with the shrinking margins of talent among the world's top athletes, it seems that the motivation to gain an edge even through illegal means will always be part of the game. As UC Davis begins the final year of its transition to the more competitive Division I collegiate arena, the school is drawing even more talented student athletes to campus who may have ambitions to go on to professional sports. Here to talk about this today are two campus professionals who work with young, talented athletes, just the people most vulnerable to using steroids and supplements. Ross Flowers knows about the challenge of competition as a student athlete, a coach, and a sports psychologist. He directs the Campus Sports Psychology Program for Counseling and Psychology Services. A Pac-10 champion, an All-American hurdler and sprinter during his years at UCLA, Flowers has spent the past 7 years at UC Davis helping athletes develop positive life skills as well as enhance their performance. With him is Andy Bloom, who spent nearly a decade as a world-class shot putter, winning national collegiate titles and competing in the 2000 Olympics. Now he's helping UC Davis transition to Division I athletics as our first full-time strength and conditioning coach. A member of the UC Davis coaching staff since 2000, Bloom joined the Aggie program as an assistant track and field coach, working with UC Davis shot putters and discus throwers. Gentlemen, welcome to Frontiers.
Thank you.
And I wanted to start with you. You have been a world-class athlete. You have been in a sport, shot putting, where steroid abuse has certainly been rampant. Why do athletes, especially in the field sports of track and field, why do they use steroids knowing the risk they're taking?
I think it's really the same reason that anybody else does it, to be the best that you possibly can be and achieve the most you can achieve, fame, fortune, money. That dream of winning an Olympic gold medal is alluring.
But even after they're caught, they still deny that they used it. Why do they do that?
Well, when you finish and you retire, all you have is your legacy to fall back on. So when everything is done, if you come back and say, well, I was dirty, clinics, camps, endorsements, all those things go away. So the motivation is definitely there to continue to claim that you are clean.
Were you ever tempted to use anabolic steroids?
No, I really wasn't. I mean, for me, the game was always how far can I throw, and I always wanted to see how far it could go, and it just, year after year, I kept throwing further. I got lucky. My best throws were good enough to compete on a world stage, but it cheapened the idea to me to see how far chemistry could go. I had a master's degree. I didn't need to throw the shot put to feed my family.
Now, Ross, what does it mean from a psychological standpoint when you have athletes at the elite level abusing the system and taking anabolic steroids?
Well, one, I agree with Andy. I think it cheats the system, and I think it cheats the sport. But you look at it in terms of society, it may be indicative of our capitalist society that win at all costs, do everything you can to be the best you can. And for some, that's hard to pass up. But I think for athletes, you know, like Andy, who go off their raw talent and work and really set process goals for themselves to achieve, it means more to really push yourself and push your own personal limits without using some other substance.
Now, when student athletes look at the elite level, the professionals, and they see that there's many that abuse, what is your message to them about staying clean and playing by the rules?
Well, I think it's, you know, being on a university campus and you know, always promoting education, it's learning more about yourself. And can you promote yourself to achieve the goals that you set for yourself? And so I think we talk a lot about not only setting physical goals, but also mental and emotional goals. So can you mentally challenge yourself and see how far you can go as an individual without any outside substance or use?
Now, as a strength and conditioning coach, Andy, do you run into students who ask you questions about what can I use, maybe a natural supplement that will give me the winning edge?
We deal with that question a lot. I mean, we do GNC, and the supplement industry in this country is a multi-billion dollar industry, so it's out there and the athletes are aware of it. The NCAA policy and the UC Davis policy is we don't support or endorse any supplement use. So the answer to it is pretty clear and easy. We just don't support or endorse it. And with the nutritionists that we have and with Dr. Flowers and all the other people that we have pretty good resources for giving the athletes the information that they need to succeed without it. I think it's important to get them to realize that the drop in the bucket of athletes that test positive, it's a very, very small number. They're really, as far as the testing shows, there aren't that many people on it. Sometimes it happens to be the biggest names. Justin Gatlin tests positive, and everyone says, well, if he's using it, then how many people in track and field are? And so sometimes clarifying that misconception, you know, one baseball player testing positive doesn't condemn the entire sport.
How about university students, student athletes? Do you think there's much of that use in collegiate sports?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, that's a huge population to consider. That'd be something I would think to ask the NCAA, see if they monitor that. But I think the majority, I would guess, of student athletes are clean.
What are the rules that the NCAA imposes upon student athletes with regards to drug testing, messages that they provide athletes?
Well, the NCAA has different levels of testing. And we abide by all the NCAA rules and regulations. They have a list of banned substances that universities need to comply to, which we do on our campus. We apply to NCAA rules and regulations, and our athletic department follows the campus drug and alcohol policy.
And the students, are they tested? How often, the student athletes?
We do random testing here, which complies with the NCAA regulations.
But a couple times a year or a couple times a month?
It varies per sport.
And all athletes are tested?
All athletes can be tested, yes.
Okay. And does that include both male and female athletes?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. You never hear about female athletes abusing anabolic steroids. Is that the case?
I think there's a misconception. People think about steroids, they think about shot putters and big, giant men. And the drug issue really comes in all colors. I mean, anytime you're trying to become faster, stronger, more powerful, there's some type of drug out there. The Tour de France, definitely not big, giant guys, but they're plagued with EPO abuse. And so there's all different kinds of drug issues that you run across.
How much of a deterrent does drug testing provide student athletes? Do they say, because there's a chance that I could be tested, I'm just going to stay clear of anything?
I think so. That possible mark on your record, it's a powerful deterrent. If you have that dream and that goal of going on to the next level, the NFL, the NBA, the WNBA, they're not going to look at you if you have a positive test on your record. Most of our athletes are looking towards careers. Who knows you better than your coach does? So when it comes to getting a job reference and those kinds of things, and then you don't want to let down your team and let down your coach, and I think that's, you know, a very big deterrent.
Now, I know that Victor Cani, who everybody knows, who used to run Balco, who allegedly supplied drugs to professional athletes, he said that when drugs are being made in terms of performance enhancement drugs, that you can easily change the chemical derivation of these drugs and essentially never be caught by a drug test. Now, I know neither one of you are pharmacologists, but do you think that perception is out there that an athlete might say, I can always stay ahead of the drug test if I have a good doctor who can change these chemical derivations of this class of steroids? Do you think that's out there, that mindset?
I would definitely think there's a mindset that people, as much as we may promote being positive and doing things in the correct manner, there's always going to be people out there that are the risk takers, and they're going to try to find ways to cheat. But here, we try to promote as much of maybe the correct way of approaching not only athletics but being student and student athletes that we can here.
And it's expensive. You know, you're not just going to walk into, you know, the store and buy a little home chemistry set and change Dianabol to be something that's maskable or undetectable. You're talking about having a chemist, and, you know, the Balco Labs was a pretty major deal catering to the top-level athletes. It's a little bit more prohibitive to the average athlete to just try to do something.
That's a good point. Let me ask you about UC Davis. Now, as UC Davis moves up into Division I, they're competing against other schools that may be bigger, faster, quicker, stronger. And how do you level the playing field with UC Davis athletes who may not quite have the athletic ability? There may be that desire to cheat the system in some way to compete. So how do you respond to that?
We have Andy Bloom.
Sports is its own great leveler. On paper, UC Davis shouldn't have beaten Stanford last year, and we beat them not once, but in football, basketball, baseball, swept them, wrestling, soccer. Sports is unpredictable. It's not always the biggest and strongest guy that wins. I made a career out of beating guys bigger and stronger than myself. It comes down to having great coaches, great game plans, understanding what's going on, and having the faith and dedication to train for 9 months to be ready for your 3 months of competitive season. And that's what our athletes are doing.
I kind of jokingly said we have Andy Bloom, but I think that is a big part of it, is going back to a lot of what our athletes now are training in our athletic workout room, in our weight room with Andy, is on core strength, developing those basic principles of being good athletes. And same things we talk about in educational realms when I talk with athletes is developing those basic life skills. I think approaching sport from maybe some of the more basic principles and building upon those principles, I think will be as competitive as anyone out there.
Who among the students are they most likely to listen to about the pros and cons of drugs or drug supplements?
I would guess unfortunately, I think a lot of people in the age range between 18 and 25 listen to each other. They may not listen to a parent, they may not listen to an experienced professional, but I think if we are able to provide the resources for them, people like Andy or myself who have been through high school experiences, college experiences in athletics, and maybe even beyond that, where we both have had that experience, I think we can provide some insight into what it's like being student athletes and the benefits of being clean and doing things in a well thought out and planned manner. So I think if we're able to provide the resources to student athletes in terms of people that they see as experts and now have professional expertise to add to that athletic expertise, we can be a good resource for them.
Andy, do you find that to be true, that when you're working on developing their core strength, that oftentimes you get into conversations, kind of philosophical questions and concerns with students about this whole thing about drugs and performance enhancement?
We talk a lot, and I have a nice relationship with the athletes because I'm not their sport coach and I have no effect on playing time or anything like that. So, we can be a little bit more casual when we talk, but I'm not afraid to talk about drugs and supplements and anything like that. And I've spoken in classes and I've addressed teams, and I think the most effective thing really is the stories that I can tell of guys who, I have a friend who was pulled off the field at the 96 Olympic trials. He had a positive drug test, and it's one thing if it's just a meet and you're somewhere else, but when you've flown your parents in and your whole family in to watch you compete on that stage that one time, and this is everything you've built towards for 4 years and your family's made all these sacrifices, and you have to look them in the eye and say, I'm not allowed to compete today because I cheated, it hits home a little bit more. And I think the athletes start to see the repercussions of the decisions that they make when you can put a real-life example on things.
Well, I know the UC Davis Athletic Department is very fortunate to have the two of you part of their program, and we wish you the best. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you who joined us for today's discussion. You can learn more about this subject by visiting our website at frontiers.ucdavis.edu. This fall, fresh spinach was pulled from the produce section of grocery stores throughout the nation following an outbreak of illness attributed to a particularly dangerous strain of E. coli bacteria. To date, some 200 people have gotten sick and 3 are known to have died from this illness. Federal disease tracking experts have traced the outbreak to California's Salinas Valley and to at least one farm where cattle were grazed near spinach fields. Our guests today on Frontiers are two UC Davis food safety experts who have been closely monitoring this E. coli outbreak in spinach. Trevor Suslow is a plant pathologist and UC Cooperative Extension post-harvest specialist who studies food safety issues related to fresh produce and then gets his findings out to the agricultural industry. Throughout this outbreak, he has continued to work closely with vegetable growers and processors to find solutions to the contamination dilemma. Dean Cliver is a professor of food safety in the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine and an expert on diseases that can spread through food and water. He has served as an advisor to state and federal agencies on a variety of food safety issues. They have both spent countless hours recently with news reporters, helping the public better understand this outbreak and the science behind food safety. Gentlemen, welcome to Frontiers.
Good to be here.
Trevor, first question to you. Can you bring us up to speed on what E. coli is and how this outbreak developed?
Well, E. coli is a bacterium that we have in our intestines. It can be found as an environmental isolate in many locations, but there are some types that are particularly pathogenic or toxigenic, and that's really where the concern comes in. So this one that is very much in the news over the last several years and very much related to this spinach outbreak, the 015787 type, is a particularly aggressive and virulent one that can cause illness and unfortunately death.
Now, you mentioned pathogenic. What exactly is that?
Pathogenic or pathogens, ones that can cause illness. In this case, in humans, you have, of course, pathogens that cause illness or disease in plants and animals, and some of them cross over, and they can cause disease and problems in both.
Now, Dean, this question to you. I understand that E. coli is actually very common. Why is this strain so deadly?
Well, clearly the species E. coli occurs in large numbers in the intestines and the large intestines of all warm-blooded animals, both birds and mammals. This one has some particular traits. It can attach to the intestinal lining. It attacks the intestinal lining. It produces toxins that get taken up into the bloodstream and can cause problems with blood clotting, cause kidney malfunctions, and so on. So it's a particularly bad actor. The other thing about it that's unique, or at least out of the ordinary, is back when I was learning about E. coli that could cause human illness, most of it came from people. This one has a reservoir in ruminants, especially cattle, and so the cattle aren't ill. They're apparently healthy, but they can shed E. coli 015787 or a couple of other serotypes in ways that will threaten human health.
How many strains of E. coli are there?
Hundreds. When we say 0157, that is about the serological combining sites on the surface of the cell. So we've got upwards of 157 known types of just that. And then the H7 refers to the antigen on the flagella that propel it through liquid media, and obviously we've more than seven types of that. They don't always occur in just totally random combinations, but anyway, there are hundreds of types.
Trevor, so what are some of the ways that these bacteria actually migrated into the spinach?
Well, we really don't know, and it's really premature to speculate exactly how the contamination event happened from a single source or potentially from more than one source within the production environment, if that's where it happened. Certainly there's some very strong evidence that has been released recently that would suggest that one of the implicated farms certainly had the opportunity for exposure from the exact same type of 015787 in a cattle pasture nearby.
So it could have gotten,
There are many mechanisms for the bacteria to move around. It can be through windborne aerosols, through the movement of water, runoff. It could be through small animals or even larger animals. Of course, insects can carry contamination, workers, equipment, any number of different routes of contamination to bring it to the spinach itself. And there are other possibilities, including what types of soil amendments, if any, they used in the production of that particular crop, that particular time. So that, as far as I know, is still unknown.
Trevor, tell me how E. coli could actually be taken into the spinach plant.
Well, the possibility of internalization or systemic uptake of E. coli into a plant like spinach or lettuce has been shown in model research in the laboratory with extremely high doses or numbers of E. coli added with water or to the soil. Whether that happens in the practical environment, in the real world, if you will, still really isn't known. But it's at least possible that that would be one route for contamination of the product. And of course, once it's inside, any amount of washing that might be done, even with chlorinated water or other disinfectant-treated water, is not going to be able to remove it.
Do you think you'll ever find out the cause of this last outbreak?
Really hard to know. I think, again, there's more evidence for this particular outbreak that may bring us to a closer understanding of the link between the source of contamination and events that may have allowed the contamination to be spread to the spinach and possibly even to multiply or grow on the spinach and expand or worsen the nature of the outbreak. My guess is that we're going to learn a lot more about this particular incident than many of the past ones, but whether we have a conclusive, this is absolutely what happened, I don't know. I'd be surprised, to be honest.
Let me ask you if there are any laws about how close cattle can graze to ag fields. Are there any?
Not to my knowledge. Excuse me. My own feeling is that in this instance, the cattle might be just sentinels in the sense that the water that the cattle drank and the water that was used to irrigate the fields both happened to have that strain of E. coli in them. That hasn't been ruled out by any means at this stage. So one could dictate setbacks, but I more strongly suspect that the water that's used in irrigation is coming from many miles away under the ground, and that where the cattle are vis-a-vis the spinach patch, assuming that they aren't wandering through the spinach directly, is probably less of a concern than where the water came from to begin with.
Do you agree with that?
That's certainly one possibility. I certainly don't disagree with anything that Dean has said. I think one of the issues is you know exactly what the separation was. We don't know any of that information at that point publicly. Exactly how close they were or not. So there's a lot of different aspects that still need further research.
Do either one of you anticipate changes will occur in ag practices as a result of this last outbreak?
I think there's no question that they've already started to change within the industry, and their people are reacting in ways that they think are in their best interest, such as draining irrigation reservoirs and figuring out ways to discontinue their use, to mandating certain types of testing that has always gone on to some level, but they're greatly expanding that and expanding that into areas that they haven't really done pathogen testing or even indicator bacteria testing before. This certainly, the question of setbacks and separation is being discussed and evaluated very closely. There are establish setback distances to protect surface water and groundwater, particularly domestic sources, around concentrated animal production facilities. And we've been using those setback distances just for an awareness building as guidance to what people might consider in their food safety plan, but they're not regulation yet. That was going to be a very, very tough one to define and implement within California unless there's some extraordinary changes in the future.
This is certainly not the worst outbreak of E. coli bacteria. Wasn't the Jack in Box E. coli outbreak even worse? Affected more people?
About 700 victims in that instance versus 199 or so, say 200 here. I think what captured the public's attention, or the press's attention at least, was the fact that 26 of the 50 states were represented. And that's an unusually efficient dissemination of a disease with a single fingerprint out of one, possibly a single field.
So what type of research is being done at UC Davis to help solve food safety issues as it relates to produce?
Well, we've certainly been involved for over 8 years in a variety of food safety research, trying to address the primary areas of concern, manure and compost, water, some aspects of worker more education than doing research on workers and personal hygiene, sanitation. Survival of the pathogens and mobility and persistence within the production environments, means of control in terms of different disinfectants or different processes that can minimize the risk. I mean, it covers a very wide range of topics across quite a few different commodities in California, and this proximity issue to dairies, you know, has been one component of the research that we've done.
And Trevor or Dean, could you tell me briefly, how safe is our food supply when it comes to E. coli?
Well, it's not just E. coli. Obviously, there are many other foodborne disease agents, and E. coli causes fewer illnesses per year than several of the others. But this is a pretty spectacular illness. It tends to pick on infants and the elderly, so it gets a lot of attention, and should. From the standpoint of how likely any individual is in the country to come down with this kind of E. coli, why, I'd say if they exercise reasonable precautions as far as what they eat, why, they could live a lifetime and never experience this.
What do you mean by reasonable precautions?
Well, obviously, reasonable is in the eye of the beholder, but certainly I prefer to buy from the supermarket, from recognized vendors. There are colleagues and people out there who really think farmers markets are the only way to go because the farmers live closer to the soil and so on. But my experience with the farmers market here anyway is that I get too much of the organic, natural, healthy thing, and I try to avoid food that's excessively contaminated with rhetoric.
Well, listen, I appreciate both of your time talking about food safety issues, and this is certainly an important one that we'll continue to follow. And thank you for your time and appearing on Frontiers.
My pleasure.
And thanks to all of you who joined us for today's discussion. You can learn more about this subject by visiting our website at frontiers.ucdavis.edu.